Good morning, thank you. Dennis Dobbles for Relator PPG. This case raises a critical issue that the court has discussed previously but not decided. In the Andra case versus Leftgate Holding Corporation, this court discussed this very issue. Can a Missouri court exercise specific personal jurisdiction over a foreign corporation based on a claim of negligent misrepresentation of statements made on a passive internet website? In the Andra case, the court discussed that issue, discussing the Zippo case and Eighth Circuit decisions that had discussed the effects of the internet and how that plays into the issue of personal jurisdiction. The issue did not have to be decided in Andra because there were more contacts related to the specific tort involved. In that case, Leftgate Holding sent contracts to the state, had phone calls with the state, so the court did not have to decide the issue of whether or not negligent misrepresentations solely made on an internet website could serve as the basis for specific personal jurisdiction. It's an important issue. Now, the plaintiff's or the respondent's response in this case is pretty much, what's the big deal? They cite to, as support, an article by a commentator who finds that the Supreme Court decisions on personal jurisdiction are nonsense. For example, he states, I have argued the Constitution does not require significant restraints on jurisdiction. I have argued that the Supreme
Court... Counselor, you might get a little closer to the microphone. We each have little speakers up here that make it easier to hear. Thank you.
I have argued that the Supreme Court's recent decisions are wrong, badly reasoned, or both. Goes on to state, I have on page 416 of the article that the respondent cites for support, lower courts trying to make sense out of the nonsense. We know that the Due Process Clause is not nonsense. This court itself, recently in the Norfolk Southern case, citing Daimler, said, it is a due process requirement that limits the power of state courts over litigants. We are a nation of laws, a nation that is required by the Constitution when a state court, any state court, is seeking to exercise specific jurisdiction over a foreign corporation. So in Missouri...
Do we even need to get to that? I mean, can this case be decided on the long-arm statute?
The case cannot be cited only on the long-arm statute. You still have judicial restraints on the power of the court. Let me explain.
Well, I think the question was, if there's no long-arm jurisdiction, then you don't have to get to the second question of due process.
That's true. That's very true. If there's no long-arm jurisdiction, and that may very well be the case here, because plaintiff has made a stunning admission in the respondent has in their brief. At page 17 of their brief, this is what the respondent says. Hilbolt's claims do not arise out of its purchase of a PPG product because there is no suggestion that the actual coding was defective. It was the application of the coding by FD, and FD is Finishing Dynamics, a third-party co-defendant that's not here before the court on this issue, that caused the problems. That is what, so it's not anything that PPG did.
Well, the question here, and you both cite Bryant and describe it very differently, don't you, is whether or not, assuming for present purposes they made misrepresentations on their website, was that adequate to be considered a tortious act in Missouri where someone in Missouri read it and relied on it, or is that inadequate either under Zippo or under traditional analysis
Bryant? I would argue that for long-arm purposes it's inadequate either under Zippo or under the Johnson case, which is the Eighth Circuit decision that adopts Zippo, because in both those cases they look at whether or not it was intended to be directed specifically at the jurisdiction, whether the statements were specifically at the jurisdiction, because this is the fallacy of arguing that a negligent misrepresentation on a website can in some way serve as a basis, because, for example, the principals in Hilbolt could have been driving through Illinois at the time that they read this passive statement. Well, in that case, would it be Illinois that they were driving through when they read it on their cell phone, about this statement they claim was a negligent misrepresentation. Of course not, because there was no directed activity to the state of Missouri or to the state of Illinois. It was simply a passive website. It's different than a situation, for example, and you similarly may have seen this, but for example, when I'm on a website and I do a search and I'm looking for, I often shop on Novika, and Novika is a website that when I get off of that website, then 3 days later I get onto Google and pops up Novika. Mm-hmm. You just looked at this. Shouldn't you be looking at it again? Why don't you buy it again? That's not a passive website. Those are specific contacts directed to the state. So then,
are you saying that a passive website can never be intentionally, specifically directed at all states?
I don't believe that it can be specifically directed for purposes of a negligent misrepresentation. The Johnson case, for example, when it looked at the issue of the effects test, adopted the standard that it had to be an intentional act, and they divided it up as such.
I'll interrupt you and then let you do it, because sure. The question is, can you intentionally direct a passive website to all states? That your marketing plan is you
yes,
want to cover
and,
all states.
And if you did that, then you would essentially have general jurisdiction through the use of websites. But, and that's why that's a fallacy of just saying a passive if there's no additional contact.
You're saying you can't have general jurisdiction on those facts under the Supreme Court's recent decisions, but you would, in effect, be creating it contrary to Daimler if
right.
you said that was adequate.
If you would say that a website, which is out there, could be around the world, not just directed to the states, if you're saying that just a statement on a website that provides information is sufficient to allow for specific jurisdiction, you're essentially saying you can have general jurisdiction over anyone in any state because of information that was posted on the website.
Well, the Zippel test, that case is 20 years old, and the Internet has certainly become more sophisticated since then. Where do you draw the line then? So are you saying if there's a box you can contact us and there's communication between the user and the vendor, that's still passive?
If there was contact, if for example, Hillbolt had alleged that they had got on the website and they read this information, and that the website allowed them to connect to the corporation to obtain additional information, if the Hillbolt had then said, I had that contact, they responded to me and gave me additional information, and it was that additional information that they provided upon which I based my decision, then I would agree that we're starting to move up the line, because due process, as a practical matter, is a requirement that we look at all of the contacts to determine whether or not the defendant, in this case the relator, purposely availed themselves under the facts of that specific case. It's not just a number of contacts. I mean, International Shoe, when you look back at International Shoe back in 1945, specifically says that it has to be the contacts that relate to the tort itself that cause the basis for personal specific jurisdiction.
You're saying misrepresentations on a website would be like, say, misrepresentations in information about a pharmaceutical product or information about some other wheelbarrow that you made and sold all over the U.S. But we used to find things like that sufficient for general jurisdiction, but
we
the Supreme Court has said it is not, and if it's specific, it's specific every place, and that can't be specific if every place in the world considers that sufficient for specific jurisdiction.
That's exactly what Daimler, Bristol-Myers Squibb put the brakes on. What the Daimler and Bristol-Myers Squibb said was that we can no longer just say because you're doing business that's sufficient for general jurisdiction. So what they did now is push back to the analysis. Now, in a tort situation or in a claim where there's no general jurisdiction, you have to look at the specific tortious conduct and say, are the conduct that's involved here sufficient to give contacts that you could say it's then fair for that tort?
And your opponent relies upon Bryant. Can you distinguish that case?
Excuse me.
Your opponent relies on Bryant. Can you
yes.
distinguish that case?
Yes, the Bryant case is different in this sense. The Bryant case. If we look at the facts of that case, the Bryant case says this. While the Bryant case looked at a variety of different factors, not only that it wasn't negligent misrepresentation, there was intentional conduct that was involved. There were statements that were made into the state of Missouri, payments were made into the state of Missouri, contact over time in the state of Missouri. So it wasn't just a simple contact.
Well, Bryant says, where a defendant knowingly sends into a state a false statement intending that it should there be relied upon to the injury of a resident of that state, he has, for jurisdictional purposes, acted within this state. And here, nothing was actually sent into state of Missouri.
Correct. And in Bryant, it had emails and telephone exchanges that were specifically relied upon. They, in 2007, sent materials into the state. So it wasn't just incidental contact, such as a passive website that was set up where information was provided.
Does Zippo go to specific and general jurisdiction, or does it go to where the tortious act occurred, or to both? How would you characterize it? Because we've kind of been going back and forth between those two here in the discussion.
I do think that if it was an intentional act in the sense of an intentional tort, fraud, where, as in, this is where the effects test comes into play, I think. And in the effects test, the Johnson versus Arden, the Eighth Circuit, said that it was an intentional act, an intentional tort, uniquely and expressly aimed at the forum state. Uniquely and expressly.
Bryant deals with where the tortious act occurred for long-arm purposes, as
correct,
opposed to
long-arm
general
purposes.
And specific.
And I'm talking about the additional overlay of due process and how that would then limit additional time. It looks like my time is up. I thank you for your time, and if there are any other questions at some point you wish to ask it, I know I don't have time on rejoinder. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The question this court must answer today is, can a Missouri resident seek relief in Missouri courts when they are injured in the state of Missouri by the misrepresentations made by a defendant that has extensive systematic contacts with the state of Missouri when those misrepresentations were put on a website and the preparation of that information and the posting of that information to the website may have taken place outside the state of Missouri? Or must Missouri residents who are injured in that way be forced to travel to conceivably the four corners of our country in order to seek relief?
Did your client exchange or send information to PPG via the website?
No, the contact out of which our cause of action arises in this case, Your Honor, is the misrepresentation, the multiple misrepresentations made by PPG on the website. But we did not send anything through the website.
And they didn't send anything to you from the website?
They did not send anything specifically to us. They didn't email us anything, for example. Our contention, Your Honor, is that in the year 2018, the internet is how business is done. It is, particularly in a commercial context, the way that businesses transmit information to consumers and potential consumers is through the internet. It is the equivalent of the Postal Service in 1970. It's the equivalent of the personal messenger in 1900.
And back in 1970 and 1980, for instance, in State Expos Brandio v. Clymer, we said simply being called and being asked for information is not adequate. You have to purposefully send something into the state of Missouri, physically mail in that instance, or make the call, provide information. That was not adequate then. Why is it adequate now why would a passive website be adequate now?
Well, there is nothing, of course, physical about the internet anymore. There will be no physical
transmission. It doesn't have to be, but you have to send something in if it's not physically by email. That's why we asked about that question.
Well, Your Honor, the purpose of PPG's website is to transmit information.
To the world?
Yes,
so there's specific jurisdiction of every case brought against them in the entire world?
No, and that is the fallacy of PPG's argument in this case, which I think they've gotten wrong repeatedly. We are, first of all, we're not suggesting that there would be general jurisdiction. I think the court has, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear that that's not an available path here. But if PPG makes a misrepresentation on its website, I would agree that it could be subject to specific jurisdiction in any state where a similarly situated plaintiff to my client reviews it, relies upon it, and is harmed by it, but that's not enough. There is also the question of minimum contacts, purposeful availment.
And that's where you're bringing back in all the things that used to be relevant, and many of us might have thought were, should still be relevant to general jurisdiction, but the U.S. Supreme Court has said they're not.
The U.S. Supreme Court has said they are not relevant to general jurisdiction.
But you're, they've also cautioned that you cannot do, in Bristol-Myers Squibb, you cannot kind of take all the general jurisdiction factors that used to be relevant before Daimler and use them to boost a claim of specific jurisdiction. It's kind of a faux general jurisdiction. Use it as a substitute for what used to constitute general jurisdiction. And when you're asking us to look at all those factors, the fact that they have business here and so forth, we rejected in Norfolk that that was enough. I understand the reasons why you think it should be enough, but given what the Supreme Court said in Daimler, and they've said since, you, that doesn't mean you can just turn what used to be specific and what used to be general into specific. I don't see how you can make that argument that
you're
making
now.
Your
Honor, I think what cases like Daimler and Bristol-Myers Squibb and cases from this court have said is when we're talking about specific jurisdiction, there's three things. There's the long-arm question, which I'll set aside for the moment. And then there are two more questions, two more tests that must be met. One is that the cause of action that is being asserted by the plaintiff must arise out of one of those contacts with the state, one of those specific contacts. That's one part. But the other part is that traditional notions of due process and ultimately fairness, if we take a step back, going all the way back to International Shoe, the concept of personal jurisdiction is founded on fairness. Is it reasonable, is it fair for this defendant to be hailed into court?
And in a specific jurisdiction case, if you have one single contact, an isolated incidental contact, but the claim arises out of that contact, you have sufficient due process basis for jurisdiction, correct?
You might, and I think the court has said that it is possible for an isolated contact to be enough, but what we're saying, Your Honor, is that you still must meet both that test, that the cause of action must arise out of that contact, and also that there must be still be minimum contacts between the defendant
and the
state.
What's your authority for that for specific jurisdiction it has to arise out of a contact with the forum state and anything else?
Well, Your Honor, I believe this court's ruling in Andra in 2015 addresses both of those inquiries. This court did not just look at, does the cause of action arise out of a contact? The court also went on to talk about the overall context and the notion of purposeful availment, which is kind of a different way of saying the same thing. This court, the defendant in that case, Leftgate Property, actually made this very argument. And this court said, though Leftgate contends that the scale of its commercial activities in Missouri is not relevant under a specific jurisdiction analysis, courts since International Shoe have looked at whether a defendant purposely avails itself of the privilege of conducting activity. So it's a second part.
And we did do that, and historically we've always looked at that. It seems the Supreme Court has now in effect said, however, that specific jurisdiction is based on the context. You might look at that to decide if there are enough context to say it arose out of context with the state of Missouri. But they've said if you have that, that's enough. And for general, they've said if it's your home state or principal place of business, that's enough. And they seem to have left our traditional analysis, which you very accurately quoted, behind. That's not relevant anymore.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Clearly, the court has said that, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that with respect to general jurisdiction. I don't believe the U.S. Supreme Court has ever said we're throwing out the concept of minimum contact.
Tell me, regardless whether they have that additional requirement here, tell me how this occurred because of a tortious act in this state, and tell me why it arose out of a specific act directed to this state or in this state, because that's where the focus of the disagreement lies. And in particular, I want to understand why you say Bryant supports you, because Bryant clearly does not say making a fraudulent statement someplace is enough. It repeatedly, again and again, says that you have to direct it towards the state, that these fraudulent misrepresentations are made by phone and letter into the state, and even quotes Hansen from the U.S. Supreme Court saying, unilateral activity of those who claim some relationship with a non-resident defendant cannot satisfy the requirement of contact with the forum state. So it seems like we would have to go beyond what Bryant said in order to find for your client.
Okay, well, two things. First, let me address the unilateral activity for a moment. This is not a case of unilateral activity. A misrepresentation case, like any misrepresentation case, is bilateral. There's a speaker and a listener. And the fact that they put these misrepresentations on a web page as opposed to a newspaper advertisement or a brochure that gets mailed out, in our view, is a distinction without a difference. It's still a representation. They speak it, they transmit it, and then we hear it. Hansen versus Denkla, where the unilateral activity doctrine sort of arose, that was a case of, we all heard it back in law school, I'm sure, that, you know, the Delaware trustee, the guy sets up a trust in Delaware and the grantor then moves to Florida and dies. And the Florida court tries to assert jurisdiction over this Delaware trustee, and the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, understandably said, no, wait a minute. We're not going to base Florida's jurisdiction over a Delaware trustee on a third party's movement into that state. This is not a case of unilateral activity. There's two parties that have to act in order for a misrepresentation claim to be stated, the speaker and the listener. So with respect to your question about what is the tortious activity that took place in this state, Bryant and Andra as well, and a Longshore case from the Eastern District before that, stand for the proposition that when a defendant commits a tortious act, be it outside the state or otherwise, for purposes of personal jurisdiction, that tortious act is deemed to have taken place here.
But that's not what it said. I just read you what it says, and it does not say that. It says you have to direct the fraudulent statements to someone in the state, mail them by telephone, come in and repeat them, and it talks about all the letters and calls that came into the state by the person in New York and said that was sufficient. It does not say what you just said.
Well, Your Honor, what it says, the discussion with respect to the long-arm statute is that clearly the long-arm statute is met because extraterritorial acts that cause actionable consequences in the state of Missouri are subsumed under subsection 3 of the long-arm statute.
It has to be a tortious act in Missouri, and so that begs the question, what is in Missouri?
Well, it doesn't have to be a tortious act. It says extraterritorial acts. That's the language this court uses, extraterritorial meaning outside the state of Missouri. And so that's our contention here, Your Honor.
Tortious consequences in Missouri.
Right, right. And the consequences did take place in Missouri. And, you know, to back up even further, this sort of begs a difficult question.
It says, no, C3 is the commission of a tortious act within this state.
Right.
But that's what you have to show.
But what this court said in the Bryant case, Your Honor, is that extraterritorial acts that cause actionable consequences in this state are subsumed under that subsection. You have committed a tortious act in this state for purposes of personal jurisdiction when you have undertaken actions that have caused actionable consequences in this state. That's what this court said in Bryant, and in Andra, the court repeated the same language, talking about fraudulent activity that causes consequences here is subsumed under the long-arm statute.
You say fraudulent activity, which is an intentional tort. Does it matter whether the extraterritorial act was intentional or negligent?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I think for purposes of a tort claim, whether or not the conduct was intentional really should have no impact on the jurisdictional question. And in this case, we've alleged negligent misrepresentation, not fraud. But the misrepresentation, the elements of the claim don't really, and this goes to a little bit about the Zippo case, which I want to also address before I run out of time here. You know, the Zippo case talks about this sliding scale, and it basically says that the likelihood of jurisdiction is directly proportional to the interactivity level of a website. I would submit that it, in the context of a misrepresentation claim, be it fraudulent or negligent, it is not only arbitrary, it's almost nonsensical for jurisdiction to turn on whether or not the website has interactive features in it. My client, the elements of a misrepresentation claim are completely unaffected by whether this page that had all of these misrepresentations on it, if it had had a button at the bottom that said, buy our product here, or if it had had a button at the bottom that said, talk to one of our representatives here. Why would that make any difference? There's no principled reason why a misrepresentation claim jurisdiction should turn on the interactivity level of a website.
So your argument that Zippo is inapplicable here, are there any states that have declined to follow Zippo?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any states that have declined to follow Zippo. I'm also only aware of a couple of states that have adopted it. I think that in the early days of the Internet, and I think you're the one who pointed this out earlier, that perhaps that test might have made some sense with respect to certain claims. But the Internet has evolved in such a way that, I mean, the Zippo case even talks back then about the sort of highest level would be the sharing of computer files. That's not what the Internet is, at least not in 2018. If we're going to say that a commercial entity can put whatever they want on their website, throw out any misrepresentation they want, and as long as that website is passive, too bad. All you can do is go to, in this case, Pennsylvania, to seek relief. There is no principled reason why a communication via the Internet should be treated differently than a communication in a letter. Because for purposes of doing business in this day and age, when you put things on the Internet, you are doing so both with the knowledge and the intent that your customers and potential customers read it, rely on it, and act on it in choosing either to use your products, goods, and services, or in this case, for us, in choosing which of their approved applicators to use. Those are representations, and I know it's a little bit unusual to think of it in those terms, but I think the Internet has evolved and commerce has evolved on the Internet to the point where misrepresentations, at least, that are made on websites have to be treated the same way that we would treat any other communication 25 years ago. And when you put misrepresentations on a website, yes, you are communicating to all 50 states. Now, that doesn't mean there's jurisdiction in all 50 states. Again, you would still, in my view, you would still have to show that there are minimum contacts such that it is reasonable and fair for that defendant to be hailed into court there.
Well, this was 50 years ago, and following your analogy, if they had sent a letter in to Missouri with the negligent misrepresentations, nobody would have asked whether there were other contacts. At that point, they would have said that's the claim is arising out of the contact. So why I keep losing you when you bolster your specific jurisdiction arguments with general jurisdiction facts that aren't sufficient for general jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the minimum contacts type of analysis is, we're not using it here for general jurisdiction, but we do believe that, again, I would go back and say the U.S. Supreme Court has never said you don't look at those questions anymore. And the example I would give would be this. If a similarly situated plaintiff to my client had the exact same fact scenario, but they were based in Maine, and PPG had no other contact with the state of Maine, no stores, they weren't registered, they didn't have lawsuits there, employees there, and so on. I think that would be an example of a case where there, because there's only the one contact, the Internet, that might not be sufficient for specific jurisdiction. That would be a much closer case.
What if it was not a letter, but it was an ad in a national newspaper?
I would say that an ad in a national newspaper would be treated very similarly. If your intent, when you put an ad in a newspaper, USA Today, let's say, the reason you do it is because you want to communicate information to customers and potential customers throughout the country. You know when you place an ad in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that it's going to be mostly in St. Louis.
And does jurisprudence say that subjects the company to specific jurisdiction?
Well, I think it could subject the company if a plaintiff relied on it to their harm and if that defendant who placed the ad had minimum contacts such that it was fair and reasonable to assert jurisdiction. I think that's what this court said in Andra. You looked at both of these things. You didn't stop at, we're going to look at the claim and stop there. You also looked at purposeful availment, and I think that was the correct thing to do, and I think that's still the state of the law. We're not suggesting there's general jurisdiction here, but those contacts, that litany of contacts, remains relevant to specific jurisdiction for due process purposes. Thank you.
The respondent made clear that the information that they've received was solely from the internet and that there was no effort by the relator, PPG, to send information specifically directed at them in Missouri, telling them about the product, advising them that they should use Finishing Dynamics, and that Finishing Dynamics would act under a perfect standard, that they wouldn't misapply the product. And that was the point I was getting at earlier when I was talking about whether or not they even have long-arm jurisdiction in this case, whether there was in fact a tortious act, because if you look at the allegations of the complaint and the page 17 that I pointed out in my opening comments, what they say is that they were an approved applicator. What they say in their petition was that that's what PPG's statements were on the website. Now they're saying that it was Finishing Dynamics that improperly applied the product. They don't say that PPG ever represented that Finishing Dynamics would not make a mistake, that Finishing Dynamics would act properly in applicating the product. So under the law,
did the website say anything about approval, how approval is done, or why these people were approved?
They didn't cite anything in the petition saying that the approval says that we guarantee that they will always do it accurately and adequately. That's not a statement on the website that they say was there. All they say is, if you look at the petition, that those were the statements, that they were an approved applicator. And the significance of that, and that's why I pointed out in their papers in this court, is that they've acknowledged that it was improper application that was the problem. By acknowledging that, they take out really the long arm statute itself. And for that reason, they don't have long arm jurisdiction. But even if we assume that they did allege a negligent misrepresentation, it has to be an intentional act on the website itself and an action where they then communicate with PPG. Because it's simply posting information, as you've all discussed, so that it goes out to all 50 states without anyone showing that that contact was directed specifically at the state or specifically at the respondent.
What if they did allege that in their petition, that they had discovery that suggested that PPG actually set up this website to develop business in Missouri?
If they had alleged that, Your Honor, then when we challenge the basis for personal jurisdiction, they have to demonstrate that those allegations are true and have a basis for it so that they can then demonstrate that there is personal jurisdiction. Otherwise, you could just allege something, and by alleging it, you have jurisdiction.
But if that was alleged and they could establish that, would you say that there was specific jurisdiction?
If they alleged that it was intentionally directed at Missouri and we challenged it and they were able to demonstrate that it was intentionally directed at Missouri, specifically intended to be relied upon, and there was that, there would be a basis for, in an intentional tort context, I believe there would be, if they could show that it was understood the damage would occur as a result of that in Missouri.
You're out of time. Thank you.